watercolor
became a primary medium first out of curiosity, and it was a difficult medium to learn. But then I did start thinking about the commerce part of this, because I thought, if I am ever going to be able to enter the art world on any level, I have to perfect my abilities and my skill set, because the genre that I was in, these kids have gone to Europe, they studied under master artists, they've known all kind of techniques that I did not know, and they were not always sharing these techniques in college at that time. So I had to read books and figure out a lot of things. The way I use watercolor is very, it's a very unorthodox way. I don't have a formula whatsoever. And part of my reasons for really wanting to perfect watercolor is because I realized the rapidness in which they could dry. And I thought, if I could perfect this with clarity, with depth, and with really content, this could propel me economically and help me shape my future. And so I am a workaholic, I will tell you. I'm a workaholic. And my paintings vary in size from 1 by 2 inches. I used to enter miniature shows, small miniature shows. I remember my auntie coming to one of the shows, and I sold a little painting for like $2,500, like 1 by 2 inches. And she says, how could you sell that for $2,500? You know, I tried to explain it to her. So I work in a range of sizes, and I don't throw away anything. I recycle everything. And that includes watercolor paper. If I mess it up, I gesso over and I do a drawing or sketch. I'm very conservative in that way. I don't waste materials whatsoever. And what I've come to understand about doing a variety of sizes is that you give an opportunity for those who do not have a lot of wealth or means to buy your larger, more expensive works. And so you wind up hitting a lot of people who may really, really love your work and may really be appreciative of the content, you know. So there was a method to it, because though it is my passion, I also understand it is also a business. And I've talked about that with different artists, because, you know, I said, you see this great museum that you're walking through and all this? It takes money to run this institution. It takes philanthropy. It takes, you know, it's culture, yes, but it's also a business. And I've learned to use both sides of my brains in working that way. And I invested my money and I saved. I rode around my same car for 15 years. And I was able to sponsor things that I thought were of merit. I did a lot of things that a lot of artists did not want to do. And I also recognized when I was in Kansas City, I would get involved with a lot of different art groups. And I recognized that the only people that were attending these events were other artists. And I thought, wow, this is not going to work out either. I got to figure out something else. And I recognized the difference between a local market and an international market. When I got in New Orleans, I recognized, oh, this is an international city. It's an international market. More people who come from different backgrounds and cultural sensibilities were more open to buying my work as well. They were educated, and I think that makes a difference in terms of what people will buy. They are secure in their own taste and what they like. They don't need someone to tell them they should like it because of thus and so. It either speaks to them or it doesn't. And one thing that I have learned from some of the billionaires that I have been around who have collected art is that these people are well-read. They have a lot of background in history. They also understand the complexities of artists getting known. And sometimes those artists don't get known during their lifetime. You look up the person that they ignored gets pushed to the forefront. That's happened repeatedly. So I've learned a lot with being an artist, and I've learned a lot about people and what they're actually looking at. Some people don't really know. They just know if it looks like something. And the thing that I loved about the New York Times review was that I said, you know, when you put your work in front of someone who doesn't know, it looks real, but they don't understand what you're doing with the space, with the edges, with the content, and the spiritual part of it also. And that's why I learned, you know, at some point when you're a beginner, at least for me, when I first went to a museum, I was so in awe of the skill set, the ability to move paint, to form something real. And then the more I did it, the more I perfected it, the more I pulled back from it. And then I start looking at non-objective work, things that didn't have any representation whatsoever. And I start marrying the two between, this is what separates my work sometimes from other artists. It's the abstraction, the placement of the forms, it's the way I use the edges, it's the space, it's the color, it's not only just a narrative, aside from the spiritual quality of it, there's also the interwoven conversation of the viewer looking at the work and what they're pulling from it. And so I've learned to read more too, because when you're in this field and you have an art critic that calls you up and they start talking to you like I was when I was in the Studio Museum, they called me up. They realized this little country guy from Quincy, Florida knew a lot about art history, knew a lot about the different movements, knew a lot about, and then suddenly there's a wall that goes up, because I'm very upfront, and sometimes that makes people uncomfortable. Because they asked me about this show, the Black Women, I said, yeah, I expected to get hammered and thus and so. I said, but, you know, the playing field can change anytime white people decide to change it. I said, Norman Rockwell is not at the Guggenheim. And I said, at one time, he was just an American illustrator. But now someone in positions of power decides that he is now a great American painter. Who decides that? You should read The Power Broker, The Fall of New York, The Power Broker. Robert Moses, The Fall of New York. It tells you about the structure of American culture and how it is formed. Robert Moses is New York. The highways, the way he built them. Certain people were marginalized by their own existence and preyed upon themselves by the lack of relief within a concrete jungle as New York. So power, you don't even realize sometimes how your future is being shaped by politicians, by laws. You know, power is really something. And I recognized that when I did my own book. I had made enough money and I was discouraged to do it. I was discouraged by the very people who represented my work. And I thought, well, this isn't making any sense. You don't want to do it. You don't want me to do it. Why? What is that? Is it power? Is it fear? And I was like, no, you're going to shape my life like that. I'm not going to wait till you decide I'm good enough. I'm not waiting. No. I watch people in the South wait for people to be right, praying for people to be right. People are flawed. They are imperfected. They're imperfected. We're not gods. We're just flesh and blood. I have learned that one person's opinion is just their opinion. Even an art critic, it's just their opinion. That's all it is. And my grandmother's right. You get a good education, whatever information people are putting before you, you will decide, is this information really for me? Or to control me? Or to keep me from living my American dream and making my life better in the physical world? And that's how I've lived my life. I don't let people shape my future. The world is too big. It's too big. It's just too big.
Hey, I got a question. Considering that we're celebrating Mayhew with the show, two questions. You know, your thoughts on Mayhew's work, and if you're familiar with it over the years. And then second, you know, being a part of this show, celebrating Mayhew and so many other artists that have celebrated landscape painting.
You know, I got a call from the young lady who did a lecture. Yeah. And she asked me, and I was a very frank and honest with her. I said, I was not very familiar with Richard Mayhew. I became familiar when I saw an article in New York Times on him. I believe it was this year too, or last year. And I knew he was Native American, part African American, but I knew very little of his work. But when I did see it, it did echo George Ennis somewhat, but he has his own He has his own. He has his own voice. But the way he captures atmosphere and the way he, there's a spiritual quality to his work. The softness and the airiness of his work and the beautiful color and where he layers things is very interesting to me. And I felt like his work should be held in esteem just like Amartya Rothko. He does the same thing with the landscape. He should be in that breadth and depth to me. And again, here again, a great American painter, and why don't we know as much about him? Why don't we? The painters that I knew were doing the African American figure. James Carey Marshall, you know, Jacob Lawrence, Henry Tanner. It all dealt with very few that I see engaged in landscape. I knew about Bannister much later, Duncanson, some of those artists, deceased artists. But my education, they said nothing about Black painters. There's nothing about the Studio Museum of Harlem and the artists protesting the Metropolitan Museum and all this stuff. I learned a lot of that stuff from my friend Bob Ragland. He sent me so many articles, I was like, oh my God. I had no idea of the complexities of being an artist in our culture. I was just a kid who wanted to learn to paint and draw. I had no idea. No, did I know Mr. Mayhew's work? No, not until recently, to be honest. I didn't know not much about him at all.
What artists were you in fellowship with throughout your career? Other artists? Did you have relationships with like your contemporaries?
Well, you know, mainly the artists that I knew were, I met were at Hallmark cards. I mean, you know, you gotta understand, I grew up in the rural South. There was hardly any artists. I knew about the Highwayman. I met one of those artists who did landscapes. Can't recall his name right now. And that was because I was doing something with the state of Florida, Secretary of State, and I got a chance to meet him. And then I went to Columbus College of Art and Design. I met an artist much later by the name of Bing Davis, who's a sculptor, and does wall ceramics type things. There was a gallery that opened up. There weren't many Black galleries at all in Columbus at the time. I remember a gallery opened up by a photographer. I think his name was Kojo, I believe. And we went over to his gallery. And there was a lot of Black artists who had actually studied in Europe, went to Europe and everything. And we were so awestruck by, they could not sell their work and their prices were very, we were very puzzled by all this stuff. When I graduated, I went to Kansas City. And there was a guy named Ed Hogan. He was a printmaker. There was Robert Powell, who was a sculptor out of St. Louis. There was Jonathan Knight. There was Tom Blackshear, Ezra Tucker, Floyd Cooper, who did a lot of illustration book, children illustration books. There was Jerry Pinkney that we knew of, who was an illustrator. And most of the artists from Kansas City that I knew, there was one artist by the name of Mark English, who was one of the highest paid illustrators, Mark English, Bernie Fuchs, Bob Peake. You know, they were mostly all white. There was no African-American galleries. There was one that opened up that I got introduced to some of the local artists there, very few, that were able to make a living. Most worked as a teacher, or they worked at the post office. They did other jobs. But that was pretty much my circle. After that, I became extremely isolated. Isolated because the shows that I was entering in the Black community, they had very little prize money. Very few people came to purchase anything. So I had to figure out another way. And I said, I'll never make a living. My mother's right. This is very complex. The galleries that I was in, the white people didn't even want to buy the work. So I was always in survival mode. And so when artists of color would come over, when I got let go, I'd end up in an old small apartment. Artists would come over, want to go out, they want to have coffee, they want to do this, they want to. So I don't have time for that, I got to work, I don't have time for that. you know, and I was always a worker. And pretty much, I pretty much stayed pretty isolated. I did meet Ed Dwight, who's a sculptor. Ed and I were in a couple shows together. We used to laugh together because they would put us back in the same little area. And we called it the Black Corner. We made jokes. And he said, yeah, what is black art? Is black art black people doing black people? Or is it white people doing black people? We used to make this funny joke about that. So, there was very few because I was always in the studio working. And the ones that I did know, some were Caucasian. But I rarely hung out with a lot of artists. Now, the time when I did hang out with artists, they were students. So I was teaching a drawing class in figure drawing or something like that. I would meet young up-and-coming artists. But as I got more known, my time became very precious to me, especially when I'll tell you, when I ended up with Bryant Galleries, there was no time to do anything because I was working like an animal, because I was working out of passion and fear at the same time. Because you have to understand, it was a crazy thing to go to a show and you've sold $500,000 worth of artwork when you walk in the door. And I was young and I was scared and very quiet. I didn't tell people I was doing well at all about it. And I was very isolated and became even more isolated. The more I got known, the more isolated I became, because I was with Bryant and some of the African-American galleries that I were handling my work were upset. They weren't able to sell the work like the way he could. And I was accused of, you know, a lot of different things by within the black community. I had a critic that would come by and stop coming by to review my shows and say, I can't review your shows anymore. It's upsetting the other galleries in New Orleans. I had that too. But I was very isolated in so many different ways. And I was successful, but very isolated.
Very isolated. So we got time for one more question.
May Bob Bragland rest in peace.
Yes.
We used to, my wife and I moved here from Denver.
Oh, okay.
And Bob was an irritant.
He was. That is the truth.
But he was really, his whole thing was that there should not be any such thing as a black person who was a starving artist.
Yeah.
And he was adamant about that. He confronted you on your attitude and your the business-like way that you lived your life and went about the business of art.
Yeah.
And he was just really very motivational. Sometimes he really got under your skin, but you couldn't ignore him.
No,
he
couldn't.
He was very, very, very much there. You've mentioned him several times in your presentation, and I wonder what was the extent of your relationship. You said that you had talked to him on the phone. Did you ever just hang out with the guy?
Oh, you have to understand, when you're telling the story, you can only tell, you know, parts of it because they have other things to move on to. But no, Bob and I became very, very close friends. I would go out to Denver and participate in a show that Coors Beer would put together, and Bob and I would go to it. But Bob and I talked, sometimes I talked to Bob 2-3 times a week. He'd call me up and I would put him on speaker so I could still continue to work. But Bob was a consummated educator. He was constantly trying to educate me because, he said, well, you're one of the few that they, you know, they accept in, you know, you're one of the few. And he was like, you know, and that was also stressful for me. But at the same time, I recognized that some of the things that he was telling me and sending me all these different articles was educating me, because I was unaware of a lot of different things. I was unaware of the protests of the Metropolitan and all that. He sent me all these articles, so I was consuming all of this stuff. And so whenever I got a platform in mainstream, I talked about some of these issues and the complexities of them. But you got to understand, I'm preaching to the choir when there's no one in the audience that's black that's even listening to what I got to say. You know, and then trying to get the ear of the African American community that I could not even get. And I couldn't even get some of the black people to even come to the show because there was nobody in it but me. So, and Bob understood all that, you know, as did Tom Blackshear. You know, Tom Blackshear said he didn't want to go on to find out. It was too crazy. You know, it's too fickle. It was just like, it's, you know, we're not, they don't want us in, you know, they were just like, you know, where you make your money is an illustration. You got budgets for black companies and for certain companies that had a budget for black artists. And I said, no, this is what I really want to do. And I said, well, you'll never make any money. You're going to be broke all your life, you know. And the only thing that changed Tom's mind about my work was when I got invited to the Hubbard Show. I got invited to the Hubbard Show, and he saw the Southwest Art Magazine. He said, oh, my God, dang, it's Tom Blackshear. I hadn't heard from Tom in years. He just called me out of the blue. I said, what the hell? You know, I said, hey, he said, I got this Southwest Art Magazine. He said, I can't believe it. I said, what? He said, your painting is in here with Jamie Wyatt and Henrietta Wyatt Herr. He said, I never thought I would ever see this in my lifetime. He said, you're a trailblazer. I said, Tom, I'm trying to just stay, I'm trying to eat and stay afloat. He said, no, you don't. He said, we don't even understand what you've done. He said, here you are, and black people don't even know what you've done. And he said, I never thought I'd see the day where black artists would be hanging with these artists based solely on the merit of your effort and your hard work. You're in the door. I don't believe this. This is unreal. That was Tom Blackshear. And Tom Blackshear is a hell of an artist. You know that. He is one hell of an artist. And now Tom is in some of the shows I'm in out west because the illustration market did that. So he's out there now trying to regroup. His sensibility is different than mine. But it's been a challenge going into a space, not knowing if anybody's going to support you. I can't tell you the number of nights that I've laid in a hotel by myself, cannot sleep, tossing and turning. But nobody sees that. Nobody sees the attention of that. My auntie telling my mother, why does he keep going to these shows if nobody wants to buy his work? She would tell me that. My mom would come to the show. She said, Louis, why do you keep going to these shows? They won't buy your work. I said, Mama, the next time she say that to you, tell her that I said, Auntie, I'm in the room. I'm the only one in the room. Tell her that. My auntie stopped. But I can tell you the number of nights where sometimes I'd have to talk and I'm tossing and turning. I can't even sleep all night. Because when you're a person of color and you're in that space, eyes are on you. And how you handle and how you move in that space matters. And moving in that space with my head up, my confidence intact, regardless of the outcome. And Bryant Galleries also, I will say the success of that gallery insulated me whenever I moved out west because they were not as open. They were more conservative. And so when I moved in that space, you know, I said, well, how's Dean Mitchell doing? How's he making a living? Because I would barely sell. Well, they didn't realize I'd already made $500,000 before I walked in the door, but they didn't realize that. So if I didn't sell anything, I was okay with it. You know, and sometimes my commentary disturbed them because I'm talking about history and the marginalization of people and all kinds of things. And unfortunately, a lot of people of color are not there to hear that. So, and it's really sad that we're still grappling with skin color. And, you know, we have all this information now from scientists and what we are as creatures and. And it's just really heartbreaking sometimes to see how people treat each other based on social constructs and how we've made so many advances with technology. And, you know, even to get here on a plane, the way we defy gravity with machines, and yet we still, I don't understand it. God knows all this. I don't understand it. You know, I hope someday we'll evolve, but we're just not there yet. Just not there. I don't know why. We're just not there.
Okay. So thank you all for joining.